Both, Eamon. The reality of it is that with a show like this, basically you're going to get a bunch of people that show up and watch it live. This is across like multi-channel now. So we're on Crowdcast, we're on LinkedIn, we're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, those kinds of places. But all of those things will also be recorded. And then we can kind of work with the, the recording afterward. And actually, we're going to try and do a podcast by lifting the audio from it also. So we get basically multiple channels, multiple products from the same thing. So yeah, that's just what Founders Focus is. It's also basically what the vibe of Brain Food is. You know, we want to just try and have great conversations with people without too much post-production, without too much kind of massaging the message. Let's figure out, let's get some real talk and see where we're at. So
perfect.
Everybody,
well, I'm happy to be here.
I'm pleased to have you, man. Okay, welcome everybody to Founders Focus. This is the second of our double header today. And this is becoming like one of the favorite things for me to do, because it's always fascinating for me to have conversations with people that are so motivated by a problem they have encountered on in recruiting that they've gone ahead and thought it was a good idea to build a business to try and fix that problem. Most people would just complain about it and get on with their day. But no, some people have actually gone and dedicated time, effort, and resource. And that's fascinating for me, because I think we can learn a lot from the people who are doing this. What are their lessons? What are their what is their journey like? So I'm very pleased to welcome onto the show Amon Bartran, the CEO of TripleByte. Amon, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Hung. I am very happy to be here.
It's great. We need to sort of talk about me mispronouncing your name right from the beginning. So I'm pleased that you kind of interrupted me and corrected me on this. It's oftentimes I am the person that has to do this. So it's kind of funny to be on the other side. But I've never seen a name like that before. I wonder whether you could tell me a little bit about the background behind it.
Sure. Well, there's actually a connection there to the origin of my company. But I grew up on a hippie commune, and my parents wanted to give their children strange names. And so they searched far and wide and found the name Amon.
Amazing. That's actually fantastic. It's such a unique name. And actually, when you're thinking about things like, you know, domain names and stuff like this, and, you know, the, like online real estate, and sort of the ability to kind of have a unique identifier, I think it's like a kind of a useful thing as you go on, you know. So it's great to know. Interesting to I wonder whether your kind of your upbringing had any impact on your kind of, I guess, your entrepreneurial sort of journey, Amon. I mean, did you ever think that you were going to be this type of person to run a, you know, significant technology business, or did this kind of happen without too much planning?
Very much the latter, very much just happened. I fell into computer programming when I was a young teenager. I think like a lot of kind of people in the space, I figured out how to, you know, change the banana thing gorillas in QBasic and Windows 95, and sort of gotten involved with an online programming community and sprinted from there and you know, learned so much. But I knew nothing about startups or Y Combinator or anything like that. And I got extremely lucky and took a job at Justin TV.
That's right. One of the early, probably the early creator type of a type of businesses, weren't they? So yeah, okay, sorry to interrupt you, Amon. You got into Justin TV as an engineer, right?
I did, yes. I was there for 2 years, running the backend video system.
Fantastic. And how did that kind of how did that give you the impetus to go on to do TripleByte?
I apologize, Hung. I'm hearing myself echoing back pretty badly, which is highly distracting. Let me try to fix this, and I can give you much more thoughtful answers.
It's probably two browsers, I think, or maybe you've logged in on more than one thing. That's probably the most common thing, but you definitely go and fix that.
Okay. I can still hear myself. Okay, I think you're right. Okay, There we go. That is much better.
No, that's actually just, it's actually interesting because you know video, right? So that type of echo of yourself is, I don't think anybody is able to concentrate through that. It's extremely difficult.
I was trying. I was giving it my best shot, but it was wearing
me down.
Let me
tell you, I once had to do a presentation to like a large online audience. I couldn't see anybody on there, but I was told there were hundreds of people there. I heard that echo out as I was doing just basically a presentation. And over 40 minutes, the only thing I heard was my voice twice. And it was like, assuredly the worst presentation I've ever given. But I totally get it. No worries. But take us back to the time with Justin TV. So you were working as the back-end lead for this business. How did this set you up how did Triple Byte happen from that sort of base?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And So I'm just going to back up one step further to the hippie commune. That's kind of the starting point here. So I was actually homeschooled in what's called unschooling, so which is as radical as it sounds. You know, basically my parents believed that it was wrong to force their kids to, you know, study anything or to do any official schoolwork. And that's a complex topic, and I have lots of thoughts about it. But it actually worked very well for me. So I kind of had this massive amount of free time to, you know, learn to program and make fireworks and do all kinds of, you know, get into carpentry. And that ended up, you know, I got involved in online programming and game development and everything was going great for me until it was time to get into university. And basically, if you have, you know, zero grades, you've never taken the test, a letter of recognition from your parents doesn't go so far in getting you into universities, let me say. And so I kind of had this big problem and it took me a few years to actually get into any university. And I don't want to overplay this. I eventually got a CS degree, but from a school that, you know, from a very low ranked school that no one's ever heard of. And there certainly were not, tech recruiters, you know, of any kind showing up at the you know, career fair there trying to hire us. And so I find myself 2009 on the job market, applying for jobs, and I knew nothing about how to do this. This is one of the low points of my life, actually. I remember just sort of spending months and months applying to jobs and not getting a single interview. So basically, you know, the school name on my resume, and I had no internships, was such that recruiters were filtering me out top of funnel. What was so crushing about that was that it's not that I was failing; it's that they were you know, not giving me a chance to compete. Right? I couldn't even play the game and fail. I simply wasn't allowed to play the game.
Let me interject right there. I'm on 18 months. I spent applying for jobs. Nothing going on. The amount of, like, I didn't notice it then, but my morale was just getting crushed. Over and over to the point where at the end, I think I was as low as I could go. And it was almost like I would take any job until it was actually some person who I sent an application into, and she called me up and she said, look, you're way, way, way overqualified for this. Whatever it is that made you think that you're suitable for this job, that's a mistake. You need to set your goals higher. There's another issue here. Go do something else. And that turned me around. So I totally understand what you're saying, man. It's like incredibly difficult when you're applying, getting nothing back, and just a constant roll, right? I totally get it. Totally get it.
And in both our cases, it ultimately worked out. But the really kind of more depressing thing is that it doesn't always. There's a trap that you can easily fall into there. So when you get desperate like that and you can take any job, if you take the wrong job, right? So if you're desperate to get a job, you know, in your field. And so you take a job in, you know, IT automation at a, you know, furniture factory in, you know, South Dakota. And let's say you're an awesome employee and you really dedicate yourself to that job. You're great. You know, you work there for 3 years, you progress through the ranks. You know, now you're manager of IT automation at Furniture Factory in South Dakota. Then you have, you know, no degree or degree from a bad school, you know, question marks, bad school, and 3 years of experience at a furniture factory doing IT automation. At that point, no recruiter at a top tech company will consider your resume. So actually, that if you kind of deviate from the path, you can get yourself in this state where this reading just removes you from contention, and you like no matter what skills you have, you're not taken seriously by people in the industry. And that's really the, you know, solving that problem is the mission of Trilobite and of the, you know, and of the product we're building.
And this is the, I did not know this is the kind of the seed of Trilobite, which is to try and, because I think the problem we encountered was essentially credentialism, wasn't it? Like we didn't have the credentials to pass the first bar, or we didn't have the right credentials that people were screening for, and there was no opportunity for us to have any other way to be assessed. I mean, I'm pretty certain if I would interviewed, I'd probably close the interview, I guess, you know, or if it was a test, I think I could probably have done it. But we didn't get through because all they had was a piece of paper, and my piece of paper was not as good as the piece of paper from the other folks. And I guess similar to your situation. So when sort of you're just, so let's go to Justin. You're in Justin TV. You're doing a great job with this company. It's doing great. But was it always in your mind to try and fix this problem that you encountered before Justin, I guess, before that moment?
Well, there's two parts to the problem. So let me kind of take the second part. So, you know, I got this job at Justin TV, and, you know, suddenly I was in, you know, startup ecosystem and, you know, San Francisco and Y Combinator and all this exciting stuff going on. And they promoted me probably a lot faster than they should have. They were, you know, crazy startup dysfunction. So suddenly I was kind of running the back-end video team, and I was responsible for hiring. And we didn't have any recruiters actually at that point. This was sort of a, you know, I think people looked down their nose recruiters at Justin TV at that point. And so I had to decide who do we bring on site. And, you know, I would bring people on site, and most of them would fail. That's the nature of the game. And that's really expensive. It's demoralizing for the team, wastes everybody's time. And this was the kind of the key moment of insight for me. I found myself making the same sort of screen decisions that I had been so basically I was looking at resumes. And the truth is,
you were screening people out. Yep.
Yes. And you have to. There's no alternative. You have to. And to add insult to injury here, credentials do correlate. So if somebody has a degree from MIT, that person has a higher chance of doing well in your process than somebody with a degree from Southern Maine Community College. That is statistically true. And so it's not, nobody's being, I mean, yeah, sometimes people are, you know, sexist, racist. There are terrible things that happen here. But by and large, people are making reasonable, rational decisions given the data they have. And the result is this kind of pretty bad state. And so it's very painful for people in the state we were in trying to break in, but it's also very painful for companies trying to hire people and not hiring enough talent, right? And having to kind of use these kludges that, you know, only very poorly correlate with skill. And so basically every single tech company at this point is both failing to meet their tech hiring goals and also, you know, feeling pretty run down with lots of interviews and phone screens that don't go very well. And so the moment of insight for Trilobite was just, hey, this is a data problem, right? It's about doing a better job identifying skill directly. And every single company, every single team, every single hiring manager out there is trying to roll their own process. It's like we all need databases, but there's no database you can't go buy, you know, you can't go use, you know, MySQL or Mongo or SQL Server. You have to write your own database from scratch. In that world, everyone would have pretty lousy databases. And basically, that's where we are today. The status quo is every company has to roll their own process to evaluate talent. Mm-hmm. And it is just an extremely hard problem, and a problem that benefits massively from being able to look at data across, you know, hundreds of thousands and millions of people. And, you know, so the original goal of Trilobite was, you know, this is the mission, build that data set. So put ourselves in a place where we have the incentives and the time and the energy to build a data set of hundreds of thousands of engineer evaluations and use that data to make the process more accurate. And as a result, help people from the outside break into tech and help tech companies hit their hiring goals and have higher, you know, technical interview pass rates.
Yeah, I think you've described the problem from both sides extremely well there, Amon. As you say, a lot of people, we understand it's a bad experience from the applicant and the candidate perspective, and unfair, as we've discussed. You know, the people are simply, you know, walking around these bad signals, and it's like not their fault, and they could be great, but they just don't get a shot. But we underestimate how difficult it is for employers also. Like, we give the heat to the employers, but they don't want to create this bad system. They just don't have anything better to go with. And when you have nothing better to go with, you're going to go with what you've got, which is the resume, which is the credentialism. And in fact, I think what companies do, probably subconsciously, but they probably optimize their recruiting process so that the person who's gone through the more traditional way, it has the better chance of getting through. So in other words, how we assess someone traditionally is based on, okay, like the examination system and the way in which people progress academically, we assess in those types of ways. All of this very fascinating, Amon. Can you take us to the moment when you realized that Triple Byte was going to happen? I mean, it was obviously something that was in your mind. You recognized this was a problem as a candidate. As a hiring manager, you recognized it also. When was it that you thought, okay, I'm doing this? Can you describe us where, can you remember when that was? And if so, what was the situation?
Yeah. So this is my second company. So I started a company doing social video sharing from smartphones in 2011. And so that was my real kind of get the confidence, be a founder, deal with the imposter syndrome step. And that was a whole, I could talk about that. That was like, crazy wild ride. We were eventually acquired by Autodesk and got really popular in Southeast Asia, oddly. So I kind of went on a 4-year roller coaster with that startup, took a year off. And then, I took a year, traveled around, thought a lot, talked to lots of friends and mentors, and I hate to use the make a dent in the universe impact, but that kind of is the best. I wanted to do something that would have a positive impact. My previous company was really exciting, but it was largely, wasn't hurting anybody, but it was largely people sharing, jokey cat memes and videos of themselves drinking in bars were our two biggest categories. And I wanted to do something that was solving a fundamental problem in people's lives. And, I think the best advice when someone is looking for a startup idea or looking for, a way to have an impact is to try to find the intersection of something that is important in the world that's going to help a lot of people and where you have some unique insight, some unique perspective, some advantage. And so it was a fairly conscious process. And I talked a lot with friends and advisors. There's some other crazy ideas on that list that maybe I won't go into. And this was the one that we just kept coming back to. Smart people, people who I really trust kind of seem to resonate with.
Yeah. And especially if you're kind of existing in kind of the startup scene as well, it's a universal problem, isn't it? Because hiring for engineers, that's one of the hard problems that everyone persistently has. And so it's always at the top of mind. So I'm sure when you're having conversations with other founders and VCs and all the rest of it, like, what's the problem? Hiring, has got to be right up there. As a technical founder, as a person that's an ex-software engineer, founding this tech business, did you get into the code of this? Did you build Triple Byte in any way? Is there Amon Bartram code still running in this thing? What's happening with the product itself and your digital footprint on there, if you like?
Yeah, there probably is a minute amount of Amon Bartram code still running. So our core technology, right? The Triple Byte is a data company, and the core thing that we do is assess engineers and build a data set that allows us to do that in a more accurate way. Our main product today is a set of assessments that we sell to companies that they can use to screen their applicants in a way that's much more, so that solves kind of these credentialing kind of diversity bias problems and results in a stream of candidates who go on to pass their on-site interviews at a much higher rate, actually currently a 4x rate across all our companies compared to the previous tools they were using to screen applicants. So that's our main offering. And basically the you know behind that is actually a pretty awesome assessment framework that's significantly more advanced than anything that any other tech, you know, anything kind of in the Texas industry, and actually more advanced than any. So, you know, we've kind of taken a mix of technology from machine learning, kind of classic ML techniques, and mixed that with something called item response theory, which is the mathematical model that's typically behind, you know, behind the GRE and GMAT and all the big tests. And so that's our core tech. And so I wrote the first version of that. So in the first year and a half of the company, I have a background in math and data. And so the first version of that was written by me. We then hired people who are, you know, smarter than me and better than me at that. And they've probably removed, you know, 95% of my code. But there's likely a few lines still in there somewhere.
I was going to say, it's always like a kind of an ongoing joke in the engineering team, isn't it? It's like, what bits do we take out from the founder? Like, and they're always like super critical of what was going on. But I think it's often like one of the charms, if you like, I mean, maybe it's one of the romanticism in me to think, you know what, maybe there's still something, you know, there's still a couple of lines that are still in there that are doing something that went down from, you know, the founder in the first instance. So that's fascinating stuff. Hey, Amon, very interesting challenge for any sort of founder that has a specialism is how do you step away from the specialism? Because obviously the job as a CEO, as the decision maker, obviously cannot be narrowly focused. How did you learn how to like step away from this stuff? Because obviously this is something that could be a consuming, kind of all-consuming job, right? If you're an engineer, oftentimes you could just spend 26 hours a day. If there was 26 hours, you could do that. How did you have the kind of mental training or the mental discipline to say, you know what, I got to leave this aside and I got to look at marketing now, or I got to look at this spreadsheet or whatnot?
Imperfectly is my one-word answer. I think it's a really big question. So the first kind of bit of wisdom here, and I'm going to quote other people, is that the nature of a startup, kind of what it just the fundamental, what it's like to be there, what the core problems are, how it operates, roughly changes every time you double the number of people involved. So if you're three founders, you know, once you have your first three employees, the nature of the company has fundamentally changed, right? Once you have six more employees, the nature has fundamentally changed. And so as you scale up, kind of during the early years of a growing startup, just what matters, and just examples of this, right? So early on, founders have, you know, big titles, maybe they might be, you know, manager of this or C-level or CEO or whatever it is. But most of the work that needs to be done is just foundational, you know, individual contributor work. It's not, yes, it's a mix of strategy, but also the dishes have to be washed. And you got, someone has to figure out, you know, how to just like, you know, what's that going to be hosted? And all of this very specific work. So early on, that's what matters. It's that, you know, it's not, you know, you can read a book about how to be a CEO and it'll talk about, you know, communication as a core responsibility of a CEO. But that's, you know, day one, CEO of a startup, communication is not the most important goal. The most important goal is just getting an actual thing off the ground and right, and making it operate. And so something, actually, this is a huge privilege of being of kind of being CEO and running a startup, is that your job changes fundamentally, you know, every 3 to 6 months. And it's trying, it's hard, it's really rewarding. It means you suck at your job continually, because you just by the time that you're getting a slight handle on what it is you need to do, suddenly your job has changed. And this is why kind of back in the day, it used to be fairly common, you know, for investors to push to bring in outside management as startups scaled. And, you know, it made sense. Basically, here you have a, you know, look at me. I was, you know, 29 years old, and I didn't know a thing about how to, you know, manage teams of 10 people. Suddenly Trilobite had 10 people. How to, you know, I did a bad job, honestly. But interestingly, it ends up that kind of having a single vision matters more. So companies do better when there's a founder involved who has a single vision, and that person just tries really hard to learn and is humble and acknowledges that, hey, you know, yes, I suck at management. I'm going to bring in, you know, a bunch of coaches and read every book on management out there. Yeah, so that's been my approach. A startup needs the founder to have a kind of unity of focus, and that ends up mattering more than expertise. And so I have the incredible privilege of being allowed to suck at my job, and I have a lot of resources and a lot of time. So like the most important meta thing I can do is focus continually on getting outside advice, outside help, and learning the skills that I need to succeed at whatever that next core goal of the company is.
You know what? That's a really fascinating observation, Amon. Particularly the, I guess that's what leadership is in a strange way, right? Like we often forget, you know, if you read a leadership book, they'll always have like visionary is they'll always have that sort of in one of the top bullet points, but we often don't have a grasp of what that is or how important it is. And what you're saying is it may be the most important thing at this stage of business to be able to orientate the business towards that goal and to be able to say, you know what, this is the mission, this is the reason why we're doing it. And as you say, I think you'd be very humble to say, you know, your skills maybe aren't in the operational management of it, you know, the dealing with all of the, you know, the human issues that can come out that have oftentimes nothing to do with the business. But as people are part of the business, they inevitably bring those in. But the maintenance of that vision, I think, remains a key thing. And you do lose that if you bring in, let's say, an outside operator. Yeah. That may be super efficient at this, you know, I would call him an optimizer type person, versus an innovator, right? So someone who basically can make this machine super efficient, but the machine has to be pointed already in the right direction for you to bring this person in. Otherwise, it goes off down a path you don't want it to go down.
It's focus. Startups need focus. So if the business potential and niche a startup is in is obvious, then almost certainly somebody would have already done it. So typically startups are building a business in a space where there's some reason that it's not obvious it's going to work. Maybe it requires a lot of work up front. Maybe it's brand new technology. Maybe it seems like a bad idea on the surface and it's hard to see that it's not a bad idea. And so you need, you know, a founder. You need a founder or founding team. You need somebody involved who's kind of saying, no, this, you know, keeping everybody focused on, you know, there's, you know, it's going to work out. There's an idea here. It's X and building toward X over, you know, over the course of, you know, months, years. It can be very easy to get pulled in the direction of trying other things and end up kind of with too much surface area, doing a lot of things that don't work, and not making progress toward kind of a longer term goal.
You know what, Amon, I want to actually bring in some external context here, because it's just I totally agree that the aligning purpose is one of the key roles of any leader, particularly the leader at the CEO level. But the traditional way in which a CEO has been able to do that is to be, you know, physically present, everyone in the same place, doing all of those things where basically you're an on-premise business. Now, is it the case where, you know, shifting to remote or moving towards a setting where the working mode is a little bit more asynchronous, physically not proximate anymore, potentially, that seems to me to potentially increase the challenges of alignment? Is that your experience as a CEO of TripleByte, Amon, or do you think that hasn't happened, or is there a way to make it easier when there is more distribution in the team?
I'm pretty optimistic actually about this question. It's definitely a real issue, a real question. It is harder to coordinate and kind of create that sense of community and belonging and feeling in a team when everybody is interacting, you know, remotely over Zoom, over Slack, over conferencing software. But I think there's a pretty powerful silver lining there. So a lot of the things that you need to do because your meetings are happening over Zoom and Slack are things you really should be doing anyway. So remote operation forces a bunch of best practices that I think have, you know, that if you're in person, you can be lazy and not do. And so for example, let's say notes from meetings and a crisp statement of what the decision was that people can go back and reference afterward. That everybody knows that that's a really good idea. And when you're not doing that, you can get, you know, how much, honestly, how, like 50%, 60% of energy ends up going into discussing things that have already been decided in this totally unproductive way. And yet, prior to remote function, to be completely honest, at my company, we didn't, you know,
didn't
we
have were the probably the document.
Only 20% of the time or less did we actually get good meeting notes and decision, you know, published out after a meeting. And so us having to go into a remote world forced us to put in place a best of a set of practices there that we probably should have been doing all along, and that I think have increased in a bunch of ways the efficiency and health of the organization. So yes, there's some downside, but I in terms of our mission too, like our mission is kind of this kind of letting people compete for jobs from anywhere, and of course geographic distribution is a huge part of that. So helping people in, you know, Brazil, who are still strong engineers, show that skill and get jobs at US-based companies is now a big part of our mission. So we're pretty squarely behind remote work.
Yeah, very interesting. And you know, you are absolutely right. There's so many things that it just reminded me when you say that there was just a slackness involved in having an on-premise place because you could get away with a lot of things. Yeah. I think onboarding new employees is a classic example. You know, you can get away with just sitting the new employee next to this experienced person. Okay, there's your onboarding. Just listen and watch. And you know, you can't do that in a remote, or you can't even approximate this. Same thing with kind of like thinking about the employee experience overall. Like how much money was spent on amazing office physical location, you know, the high spec furniture, everything like that. You're spending money and you're basically relying on your office to wow the employees, and you know that takes care of it. What you need to do is be much more intentional about how you treat employees and not allow your real estate to do that for you, basically.
There are tons of examples. Also interviewing, right? So if someone's in the, you know, like once you get a candidate into your room, you can, you know, if they're in a you know office in your conference room, you can be, if your scheduling is a little bit off and someone doesn't, you know, there's maybe a 5-minute gap there, it's not so bad. Whereas when you're doing interviews over Zoom, you've got to have really clean, crisp, you know, everything needs to be on time. You'd have crisp handoffs between interviewers. I think there are tons of examples where remote operation
more efficient
forces just better hygiene and better function.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's the component, of course, is the sell to the candidate. A lot of it was the office, wasn't it? You know, do the office tour, check out these little perks and all these types of things, which, you know, if you were on premise, they were reasonably significant, but they were peripheral to the job. You know, they weren't actually associated with what you were doing, but in terms of an employee there. So, you know, maybe they were a little bit cosmetic in the general sense. The sort of kind of your journey as a CEO, Amon, this is the second business, you've been doing it now for 10 years, leading companies. Do you have a sense of, you know, where your strengths and weaknesses are with regards to being a CEO? You mentioned already, you know, maybe that the direct man-to-man management is I don't know if that's the right term these days, but the management of employees maybe not be the key strength. Are there strengths to your sort of game as a CEO, would you say?
Certainly. And I guess just to not undersell my company too much here. I don't think I'm a terrible manager. I think that I was a terrible manager in the past I apologize to our first 5 employees who had to report to me. Let me say that. What's really wonderful about talking to different CEOs is that there is very far from one set of strengths that work. There are people with all different sorts of approaches who are very successful CEOs. It's about coordination, right? A company is a cohort of, you know, tens to hundreds to thousands of people, and you're trying to make something happen. And if you can get those people working together toward a goal, that's an incredibly powerful force. And if they are all moving randomly in a, you know, atoms bouncing around in a gas, you know, way, that's got almost no force at all. And so getting people to work in a coordinated way is the most important goal of a CEO, in my opinion. There's other stuff that's, you know, yeah, I also need to, you know, make sure there's, you know, funding to run the company and other things. But I think it's that coordination bit. And there's lots of ways to achieve that. There are people who are really big, loud personalities and, you know, keep people coordinated by being essential. You know, they ride the front carrying the big flag and everybody, you know, follows them, and that keeps everyone coordinated. There are people who articulate a mission extremely well, who are very passionate about, you know, a mission and a social good, and communicating that and hiring based on that filter. So you get people in the company who all believe in that same mission. And sometimes, you know, that second person might not look at all like the first person. That person might, you know, do a really bad job of carrying a flag out in front of an organization. So there's tons of different ways to do it. And, you know, I'm a huge believer in getting mentorship and coaches. I work closely with a coach. And, you know, the advice I sort of give anyone I speak to about this is you need to find what works for you. And it, you know, may not be the thing that works for others.
Right. I think the worst thing you can do is kind of carbon copy something, some successful person that you think is how the CEO is, and think, okay, I'm doing that. Yes, you can learn techniques, you can learn sort of little things that they have done, but if it isn't chiming with who you are in terms of your own characteristics, then that's, you're going to be a losing game. At best, you're going to be like working really hard to be mediocre at this thing. Go ahead.
I'm just wondering how many founders try to copy Steve Jobs? Like how much cringe is there out there for people trying to impersonate Steve Jobs and have his level of like the whole, like Steve Jobs was, you know, an asshole and, you know, insisting on things being high quality. Anecdote has probably caused a massive amount of carnage in.
I think you're right, and it may well be he's a unique case, or it may well at least be he's an exemplar of a type of CEO. But as you say, Amon, I think it is a thing that lots of different types of people can do, but perhaps the secret is to learn how you do it and optimize for that. So it's almost like you've got to just lean into the places where you've got strengths and understand how to leverage that. Because it's exhausting fighting yourself. That's one of the lessons I learned too late in my life, that, you know, if you're battling your own personality off, you know, if that's what you're doing, then so much energy is spent doing this. It's going to just degrade your performance in all the other things you're doing. Understand how you operate best and then make your decisions from there. And that, as you say, could be very different types of people, and then that will have a cascade effect to the culture of the company, which is why we do get a lot of cultural diversity in terms of different types of companies behave in different ways, based on CEO, based on who that person is and how they operate. Amon, in terms of your sort of mission right now, so TripleByte, it's engineering focused. Do you sit very much on the tech side? I mean, I guess it must do in the sense that the main sort of offering is to technically assess someone on computing skills, essentially. Do you see that as the box you're playing in? Or do you think actually, you know, maybe the math behind it, maybe the concept behind it could be ported to some other field where, you know, there's a way in which we could process these things and examine them?
So what we are doing is providing assessments that take the place of resume screens and that are significantly more accurate. So it's a set of tests. They take candidates between 15 and 45 minutes to complete based on kind of how a user can select more or shorter or longer assessments. And they have a super high completion rate. So they have a much higher completion rate compared to take-home problems or algorithm problems or other ideas that are out there in the industry. And we've kind of, you know, built a data set to build these tests and made them significantly more predictive. And this has kind of all the mission stuff we spoke about earlier, helping people, you know, from any background break in, helping companies, you know, hit their hiring goals. What we're doing really should be done in other industries. You know, my brother's a teacher, and teacher hiring is honestly more broken than software engineer hiring significantly. So I would love people to take these same ideas and run with them in, you know, how are lawyers hired? How are teachers hired? How are x-ray technicians hired? However, focus is very important in the startup space. And some of our underlying math and models could apply. So we've actually done some pretty cutting edge stuff on the psychometric and data science side of things. I can talk about that if you're interested. Startups need focus. And, you know, if we tried to, you know, also work with teachers and also work with x-ray technicians, it would be that much harder. You know, so the fact that our team deeply understands the topics that we're assessing, so we have all sorts of experts. We have someone in our company called the Quizmaster, and we have people who have serious expertise in every one of the verticals that we're assessing, who are, you know, we're looking at their stats, yes, but we also have experts generating the actual content and looking at the quality of experience going all the way through. And so this is pick your battles, focus matters hugely. So Trilbyte is laser focused on assessment of people who write code full-time for their job. So most of our business is companies hiring, you know, people on the title, software engineer, software developer, web developer. We also work with folks into the data science space. We work a lot with blockchain companies. People do blockchain development, web 3 stuff. A little bit into kind of automation, QA testing. Really, if you're hiring somebody who writes code for 75% or more of their job, then our platform can make it much easier for you to find and screen talented people.
Yep. I love it. I love the focus, but I also love the kind of potential expansiveness. This is a task for another business, isn't it? Because I think each vertical will be another business. It's so difficult to get there's nuances that need to be right in different kind of industries. And as you say, I think outside of tech, I'm not sure whether there's anything like there's any innovation there in terms of how recruiting works. It's still highly credentialized. And it's then just like an interview. It's like, do I like your face? And that's it. And that presents its own issues, right? So how much we all know, again, studies have shown us that we typically are going to like people that are like us, whether that's morphologically, whether that's sort of in terms of attitudinally or whatever it might be. Similarity basically is a tick. But what does that mean in terms of like this person's capability or suitability for that job? It's actually not necessarily the best signal. So there's certainly lots of innovation, I think, available for folks that can go and give this a shot. In terms of the kind of immediate focus or immediate future for Trilbyte, Amon, what kind of stuff can customers expect from you guys in 2022? I mean, what's the roadmap looking down the pipe this year?
Yeah, this is a little bit technical and inside baseball, but I want to, our assessments is, I've said a bunch here, it's what I'm most proud of. And we are in the process of releasing a change to our assessments that I believe no other testing company has ever done. I mean, it's something called a nominal model. And this is a little bit, again, inside baseball and response theory stuff. But basically, if you look at the end response theory is kind of a mathematical modeling behind test development. And it's based on, there are questions, right? As people go through a test, they're answering questions and you are, in some sense, doing a Bayesian update. You have some prior for their skill and you're up to doing, you know, Bayesian updates based on the answers they give. That's kind of the smart way to look at how a test works. Most tests have this concept of an answer being right or wrong. So somebody, you know, like you're taking the SAT, you have answers in front of you, and you know there's a wrong answer, or maybe it's an algorithm problem. You're writing code in a browser, and that code either is going to work and pass the test, or it's going to fail and not pass the test. Yep. And that is that binary, you know, works, doesn't work, is of course very low. Like that's not the way it works, right? There's actually, you know, the reality has many more shades of gray, and so. The way the nominal model in response theory works is that rather than coding every answer as true or false and then learning based on that true or false output, okay, we're going to learn something about this candidate's skill.
You can rank the answers. Model, yep.
What was that?
You can rank the answers in terms of how optimal they are or something?
No, you don't even rank them. All you do is, so you have a massive data set of outcomes and you just say, candidate gave answer X. Hey, statistical system, go learn best fit across millions of, across hundreds of thousands of candidates, what signal we get from that answer. So you could interpret the answer in the end as a rank. There's likely some rank there. We are ultimately projecting to a finite number of, you know, scale axes at the end. But the input to the system isn't, there's no concept of right or wrong. All there is questions, answers, whether they're categorical answers as in multiple choice or whether they're qualitative answers. And then there is a, you know, a statistical machine learning system, essentially, looking at those answers, looking at a data set of hundreds of thousands of people and, you know, how did they do in their jobs at different companies. And from that learning, okay, this answer is most predictive of somebody's being strong in, you know, backend system design. This answer is more predictive. You know, this answer maybe is a bit weaker there, but it carries a lot of signal about somebody's skill in algorithms. And so it this requires a lot more data. I think no one has done it because this kind of, you know, means you need a you need a much bigger training set to avoid overfitting a model like this. But it ends up being much more subtle and thus much more predictive than kind of classic binary true false item coding. And so this is our head of psychometrics has been kind of her big pet project for a while. And so we've rolled this out now to some of our assessments, and it's going to be out across the board by middle of the next quarter. And we're seeing a pretty big spike up in how predictive an assessment is for a given number of questions answered.
This is fascinating, Amon, because essentially, this is a way to capture, if you like, unconventional thinkers and individuals that may have, like, how many people will fail? I mean, classic academia is this. You fail someone for producing a non-conventional answer, but they've simply found another way to solve a problem. But because you've structured in a bimodal way, this has to be a yes, no, this is how it works.
Yeah.
This person is relegated out. This is why a lot of the, you know, a lot of like extraordinarily intelligent people fall through the gaps of traditional academia as a result of this, because they've simply had a totally new perspective, could be super valuable, but they don't fit into the processing of the answer, if you like. So I don't think I have heard of any alternative to this or something that's come before this in terms of its implementation. So this would be really interesting to see how this would work. And again, I think it leans into the idea that a lot of solutions aren't perfect, right? I think you use the word imperfectly doing stuff. Guess what? Everything is imperfect, right? I mean, there isn't like an absolutely perfect way to do anything. So we're all just kind of gradations of imperfect. And here is a situation where maybe you can start, mapping this and saying, okay, this person generally is going to operate in this way when confronted with this type of problem. In fact, just to dive just a little bit into this, because I want to, this is fascinating for me. One of the biggest problems in terms of assessment is assessing stuff like problem solving, for instance. Because like, how do you assess someone's problem solving capability? Do you like have a single path of success, you know, present a puzzle on a single path of success, or do you just want this person to solve the problem in their own way? So long as they deliver the outcome that you've instructed them, then that in itself is a way to solve the problem. It reminds me of the Kobayashi Maru test in Star Trek, right? I don't know whether you're a Star Trek fan.
I'm familiar, yes.
But it's a classic one, right? I mean, obviously Kirk cheated, but that's how you break it. But he was failed for cheating the system. But then actually, he still won it. I mean, he delivered the outcome. And it seems to me that what you're building here is kind of trying to collect that type of person who's able to beat Kobayashi Maru.
There's not one. I think my biggest takeaway from running a recruiting company is that we all have this mental model that there are skilled people and there are less skilled people, and we want to hire the skilled people. And as a recruiter, you kind of got to have that model, right? You got to deal with the fact that lots of people are out there and they don't all have the skills you want to do your role. If you have a kind of higher level view of thousands of candidates applying to thousands of companies, what you see is just a lot noisier. So first of all, there's a great deal of noise. The amount of actual verifiable signal, so if a candidate fails an interview at one company, how much that tells you about whether they'll fail at another company is not all that much. There is a great deal of just fundamental noise in this process, and we all need to be a little bit more humble about that and try really hard to find ways to overcome that noise. It's the first point. Second point is that skills are fairly uncorrelated. So I won't name names here to protect the innocent / guilty, but early in Trilobite's history, we interviewed the head of engineering at a very famous company. So they were considering using our product, and they wanted to put the head of engineering through our process as a test. And this person did really poorly on our process. And we were like, what the hell? What do we make of this? We have this really famous engineer. And by the way, I don't want to say that we were right. So what happened there is that we had keyed in on a specific set of skills that some of our customers wanted. And we built an early system looking at those skills. And then we found this person who was, you know, leading a $10 billion tech company, that leading their tech team, doing a really good job of it. He was very strong in other areas, and he was actually worse in some of the areas we were measuring than, you know, your average recent college grad. And, you know, my takeaway there is not that, oh, there was this goofy guy, like, look how bad he really was. Like, I think he deserved his position, right? The takeaway is that there are lots of different skills, and it's less about finding the good people and the bad people, and more about saying, what are the skills that matter for a given organization and a given job? And then how do you measure those skills as accurately as possible to find the people who are, you know, who have the skills that are needed for the role and for the organization in front of you? And that's going to differ between organizations pretty significantly.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think everyone in startup probably has a similar story, maybe not as dramatic as yours there, Amon, but the high prestige, sort of coming in with a prestige background, but then suddenly not being the right fit. I love the sports kind of analogy to this. I think it's actually a really good way to think about it, because sometimes you can get a star player that was amazing in one context and one team, but then you drop this person into another context and another team, and guess what? He or she is a terrible fit. Has the player fundamentally changed? No, they haven't. Context has changed, situation has changed, fit is no longer there, and therefore that's a bad hire. And that's on the business, not the candidate. The candidate can't figure this out. It's your job to figure this out. It's a constant art and science battle on this. I think we're going to get more scientific. I think we're going to figure out a little bit more, not only about their raw technical skills like you guys are doing, but also their contextual skills. In other words, how do those raw technical skills apply in context? Unless you're working in a completely autonomous role where, you know, you are just completely by yourself, if you're collaborating in some way, how you influence others is another key component, which is actually my final question for you, Amon. Do you have a way of assessing this? Because engineering in the modern sense is a collaborative exercise. Very few people will build the thing from start to finish. Maybe someone like you at the very beginning might prototype something out. But in terms of production quality code, that's a collaborative process. Have you got anything in there to work this out? Say, okay, raw technical skills here, and how do they interact?
So we experiment a lot in that area. I wholeheartedly agree with you. Collaboration skills, interpersonal skills are in many cases more important than raw technical skills. Because when they go wrong, it causes an explosion. It's quite a bit worse than somebody just, you know, not, you know, knowing a programming language. We have found them to be they vary massively between organization. So you bring up context. Context is 90% of the signal when it comes to interpersonal skills, soft skills, communication, collaboration. So the way I would describe our product, so the answer with our current product is we've tried to run tests, and we have not been able to reliably replace the judgment of the recruiting team. What we can do is augment that judgment. So the way our product works is we do a first step in the process. Candidate applies, they go through our assessment. We give the recruiting team hard, verifiable, accurate technical skills data. They can use that to judge who they speak to. When they get folks on the phone, they have people who are going to pass the technical interview at a much higher rate than they would other ways. And this frees them to focus on exactly these collaboration, you know, soft skills, you know, culture ad, all of that. And so by removing the necessity of the recruiting team having to try to do their best to judge technical skills, the recruiting team has twice the time or more to do a better job judging culture fit and soft skills. And we have found that recruiters are better at that. No, in the future, we may, we experiment. We continually add sections to our tests. And you know, we're always taking shots at judging communication and collaboration because they're super important. But the truth right now is that recruiters are better at that than we are. And so right now we free up technical stuff so that they can do what they do well, which is judge the culture fit and soft skills.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, human assessment may currently be the optimal way of doing those types of assessments, right? Until I guess there may be some sort of, you know, I guess hugely sophisticated automaton that can potentially do some of that. Who knows? Perhaps in the near future, perhaps something that could be built by somebody, something you do. Amon, we're coming to the end of the time. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you. I wonder whether, as a final kind of word, you know, a lot of people that might pay attention to Founders Focus have themselves kind of maybe thought about setting up a business. They haven't done it yet. You know, they may be looking to take their first step. I always want to try and, you know, get a person who's gone through this journey and I get their input. Like, what's the one word of advice you would give to a person that wants to do this but hasn't yet?
The risk isn't that great. I'm going to say that. Depends on your situation. For most people, the risk isn't that great. We are lucky to live in a day and age where startup experience even fails, like trying to start a company, spending a year on it, having it not work out. Most recruiters do actually view that as a positive. It shows initiative. It shows the ability to, you know, try to make things happen. It shows some you know, ownership experience. And so the cost of giving that a shot is not that high. You know, you probably take a, you know, pay cut during the year of working on that. But it's one of those things where there's no alternative other than just jumping in. Certainly read good books, get good advice. Try to find people to talk to. Books end up being optimized for some things other than necessarily being the best advice. Try to get actual people to speak to you rather than reading what they say in books. You know, especially if you're early in your career, there's very little to lose. Worst case, you take a lower salary for a year, but it's not going to hurt. It's not going to hurt your job prospects long term. And it's the high variance shot, right? Yep. Yes, you'll probably fail. Most startups fail, but you might succeed. And every single person who has started a company had to jump in and give it a shot at some point. And so it's not for everybody, by the way. I don't necessarily like if you try it and find it super stressful and doesn't make you happy, by all means, go work at a like. You know, I don't want to say this is like that all ambitious people have to start startups or anything at all like that. Like it's one path. It's a path with positives, it's a path with negatives. But if you know in your heart that you want to give it a shot, you got, you know, there's no alternatives, just stepping off the you know, the diving board and see what happens.
That's it. You don't learn to swim by reading a book on it. You've got to get your feet wet. And you know what? I will repeat the first comment you said. The risk is not that great. And that's not to dismiss everyone's got different personal circumstances. Everyone's in different levels of privilege, etc. But most people that could take the risk don't. Because they do think it's decisive. And one of the things I think is true is that it's totally recoverable. I've failed multiple businesses before in the past. I'm definitely going to fail more in the future, right? So it's almost like, but the best thing that's happened is that I've learned that that's okay. That you can totally bounce back from it. And in fact, the learning curve is significantly higher. And also the most important thing from the journey is the confidence increases at an exponential rate. And again, I compare ourselves, if you like, Amon, to really early on when we were applicants to jobs and getting no, at that low morale point. I've never been less confident in my entire life. You compare that now to where I'm at this point. Same with yourself, I think, Amon. It's like, okay, you know what failure is and it's not that bad, basically. You can totally do it. Amon Bartrand, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for your time. I know you're a busy guy, so I'm going to let you go. I wish you and your product the best of luck. Please do let me know when you roll out this remarkable new way of figuring out how to assess people in a non-bimodal way. I think that would be very exciting for lots of people to be aware of.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed the conversation.
Take care, Amon.
Bye.
What a cool guy. Fascinating conversation. And I had no idea as to his Amon's background, by the way, in terms of, you know, his early journey. That's a conversation I'd love to explore to another time, because I think there is a very interesting argument to be had for having a diverse educational paths into society, rather than like funneling everyone into a comprehensive system. I wonder whether that's something as a society we could better manage. Anyway, that's it. I hope you've enjoyed the show. If you have, please do follow the channel. We do this every week. If you're interested in Amon's product, check out TripleByte. I'll share the link to the folks who read this, who watched this. They are an assessment tool for software engineers and tech folks. We'll be back, I think, next week. We're going to be speaking to Sayo Majos, CEO at MetaView. We're back on Wednesday. And on Friday, this is just 2 days away, we're doing Brain Food Live. We're going to be talking data-driven recruitment. So if you know what DDR is, or you want to know what DDR is, then we've got a bunch of expert guests to tell us exactly what that is. Make sure you tune in. Okay, folks, that's about it. Thanks for watching.